Advancing the cause of racial equity here in the 904. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with the new CEO of 904ward. Give us a call, 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, a look at some positive news and notes. What's good this Wednesday? But first this hour, the latest numbers on the coronavirus pandemic. The Florida Department of Health now reports 1,143,794 total positive cumulative tests for COVID across the state this year. That's since the pandemic began. So we are closing in on 1.5 million positive cases statewide. And the positive rate surged to a December high of nearly 12%. In Duval County, we're above a 10% positive rate with more than 5,000 patients with a primary diagnosis of COVID-19 in hospitals around Florida. All of these numbers reported just as the first vaccines are administered around the state to healthcare workers. So the message, as we say every day, is this virus is still very much with us. Please continue to keep masking up, washing your hands, avoiding large indoor gatherings, keep social distancing. We need to keep doing this for several more months. So I know it's hard, but that's the message, all right? Now, the pandemic has affected all of us, but particularly it has hit communities of color very hard. In Jacksonville, there have been real efforts recently to address long-standing racial inequities in this city. Is just one example. The city council has a new committee looking at the matter. This morning, we learned that Miller Electric is donating $1 million to the United Way of Northeast Florida to work on equity issues. Also, just this morning, we received a press release from the Jacksonville Chamber. They are launching a new forum and program designed to improve economic opportunity for African Americans in Jacksonville. But a group that's been working on this for a while is called 904ward. They're a community organization advancing racial equity in this city since 2015. This week, they announced they're expanding their mission, and they've also hired a new CEO. Kimberly Allen, PhD, is president of 904ward, and she's on the line. Dr. Allen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the show. And as we talk about race relations in Jacksonville and racial inequality, we want your calls. What do you think needs to be done to improve economic and social opportunities for everyone in this city? Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Well, first off, congratulations. You had been the board chair of 904ward for a couple of years. You'll be CEO beginning January 2nd. You're a Jacksonville native, used to work at Florida Blue, a small business owner. This is a big new move for you and 904ward. Can you tell us a little bit more about the organization and its mission?
Absolutely. 904ward, like you said, came into existence in 2015. Honestly, when there was just, you know, the viral videos, unfortunately, of unarmed Black people being murdered by police and vigilantes, and a group of friends and colleagues got together, and they wanted to talk about it and talk about the experiences that they were having personally, and to just be very open, honest, candid, vulnerable, and then work together to create solutions. And so that's what 904ward has been about and has always been about. And, you know, we're very clear in that we want to, you know, our vision is to see an end to racism in Jacksonville so that everybody thrives. And we do that by, you know, creating racial healing and equity through conversations and learning, building relationships, and then moving together toward collective action.
You know, over the summer, we saw protests in the city over the killing of George Floyd as the Black Lives Matter movement flexed around the country, including here in the 904. And these issues are longstanding. They're certainly not new in Jacksonville or anywhere, really. You've done such a wonderful job already of bringing these issues to the forefront, creating conversation, You have four key goals, though, that you want to advance in this city over the next several years. What's the agenda for you as the new CEO of 90 Forward?
Well, we definitely want to continue to have the conversation. We cannot move forward, I think, until we start to talk openly and directly about the impacts of race and racism and how it impacts people today. And that also includes diving into the history of racism in our city and acknowledging that racism in our city and how it plays out today. And then we want to make sure that we, you know, work to support and have people respect the Black, Indigenous, and leaders of color in our city and make sure that that leadership reflects the population that's here. And ultimately, we want to advocate for policies and priorities that will continue to make Jacksonville a city of equity and inclusivity so that everybody is thriving.
You know, all you have to do is drive around town, Dr. Allen, to see the problems. We have whole massive swaths of the city that don't have decent infrastructure, don't have access to capital, don't have opportunity. And we've seen in recent months on the Jacksonville City Council efforts to address that. Some of these longstanding inequalities come out of the 50-year-ago decision for Jacksonville to consolidate its city and county government. And so what are your thoughts about the history in this city that has led to the inequalities we see, and understanding those as a way before we can move forward and work on some of the biggest problems?
Absolutely. And I would say, Melissa, as monumental and as such a point of emphasis that the consolidation was, the problem stemmed to even before that. And
yeah.
It is an issue of you know, policies and practices that have, you know, Jim Crow era, you name it, that have led to a lot of the problems that we see. And I think that the role that consolidation played was to, you know, shine a light and say, let's unify and do this. But there are still pieces of that piece of legislation that folks are still dealing with and falling out from. And as folks have said around the community, those promises have not been upheld. And so I think it's a long history, much longer even than consolidation, that have plagued our city, and we have to be willing to discuss those things, acknowledge them, and then be willing to make some changes to make the city work for everybody.
Just this morning, we received an update from the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, an activist group that has been very vocal about the problems they see in this city, looking at how to improve public safety, bring down the high murder rate, improve relations between people and the police. And so there is a lot of pain and there is a lot of anger in Jacksonville, and it's been going on for a very long time. What would you say to people listening who you know, they're very cynical about the state of affairs in this city and in this country? They don't see these efforts as making a real difference in leveling the playing field for everyone.
I would say a couple of things. One, I would say, as cynical as I think we all are at times at many failed attempts, there are a number of things that have been successful in moving the needle forward. And I think in addition to that, there is also the thought in my mind of what if we didn't have the efforts that we have, what would the state be? Even though it's not perfect, and I don't think we can expect perfection, but I do think that we should and we can expect progress. And so it may not come in, you know, our lifetime sitting here, but there have been radical changes, and I have to be hopeful, and I encourage people to continue to be hopeful and be willing to engage, whether you're cynical, whether you're upset and angry, whether you are new to the conversation about race. I encourage all citizens to be actively involved in race relations and conversations to continue to move the agenda and keep everything moving forward.
One thing 90 Forward did recently was create the race cards. These were a tool for people to have real dialogue about race. It was a deck of cards that were conversation starters. People could share their own experiences with racism, discuss the Black Lives Matter movement, and more. And so for people of color, this is a daily reality. This is their lived experience. What would you say to white listeners right now who they just don't have the same lens, they don't have the same perspective, and often they don't feel there's a problem. They don't see a problem, or they feel it's overblown. What's your answer to those listeners, Dr. Allen?
My answer is twofold. One, it is to get a deck of the race cards and have a conversation with your close friends. And that your close friends are probably people who are very similar to you, come from similar backgrounds as you. And you may find that they may or may not share some of the same beliefs in having that conversation. But I encourage to have that, encourage listeners to have that conversation first with your close friends or family members. And then I encourage you to go out and to engage in the community conversations that are happening around the topic and to listen, because I think we all have our beliefs, and we certainly did not get to a point where we are in our lives without our experiences, and those experiences shape how we view the world. But one of the benefits of a city like Jacksonville is that it's so diverse. You mentioned all of the organizations at the top of this who are engaging in race relations and racial equity work. And so there are plenty of events, plenty of opportunities to engage and listen and hear the experiences of others. In addition to that, I'd encourage reading a number of books. On 90 Forward's website, we have a whole host of resources, things you can read, you can listen to, you can watch. That will shed some light that might be different from your own. And I just encourage people to be comfortable with being uncomfortable and challenge yourself and push yourself to exploring material that contradicts what you view, so that you can be a better ally, advocate, and just be a better informed person.
I mean, and that's real. Let's be real. That's honestly a message for white Americans, isn't it? It's trying to get white Americans to be uncomfortable and just live in that space for a while, and so that they can hear how privilege works, how it has benefited them throughout their lives. It doesn't mean they're bad people or that they've done anything wrong or that they need to apologize necessarily for their lives. It just means that they need to try to understand what the world is like for people who don't look like them. Why do you think that is so hard for so many white people to do?
Part of it is that I think there is a level of guilt that becomes associated or that has become associated with a process around understanding racial equity. But there is a quote that I have been using lately that has really impacted me, and it's from Dave Chappelle, and it says, the more room you leave for redemption, the more room you leave for people to be honest. And that's one of the things that 90 Forward does, I believe, incredibly well, is when we enter these spaces to have conversations about race, it is not a situation where we are pointing fingers and damning people for the lives that they've had or the privilege that they've had, because truth of the matter is, in some way, shape, or form, we all have privilege, whether it's, you know, privilege of different abilities or of gender or of, you name it, sexual orientation, religion. There are different types of privilege that we all can call upon in different situations. But there goes, you know, with acknowledging that privilege, there's also a responsibility.
Yeah.
Use your privilege.
And use it, right. And I want to ask you as a follow-up, sorry to cut you off. Some people listening to this will automatically dismiss everything you're saying as identity politics. What's your answer to that, Dr. Allen? When they hear person of color, gender, LGBTQ, they go, oh, that's identity politics. What's your answer to that?
it's who we are as people. And I think you have to acknowledge that as people, we all have some sort of way that we, that people identify us, whether we want them to or not. And those things play into our bias and how we act and how we treat people, whether we know it or not. And so, you know, having the ability to see someone for who they are and what they bring to the table. It's not a deficit, you know, mindset. It's that person has some really interesting perspective that we need to make sure we capture whenever we are engaged in work around race or gender or ability, et cetera. But there needs to be an awareness of it, awareness of the privilege that we all carry, so that we can use it, again, to be responsible and call into the circles that are, you know, created to make sure that there are the folks represented to give their perspective.
Sure. But, you know, and this is not complicated stuff, honestly. I mean, I have the privilege of hosting this program, right? And I do consider it an honor and a privilege. I do. And so one way I try to honor that privilege is by shining a light on people like you, Dr. Allen, and organizations like 90 Forward, because if I'm lucky enough to get to do this job and get paid money to talk into a microphone every day, you know, I try to help others with this platform when I can. And, you know, that's just one example. So let's go to some calls now for Dr. Kimberly Allen of 90 Forward, 549-2937, Mark in Murray Hill. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make two comments real quick. I was a recent student at FSCJ, graduated now finally, but one thing I notice is that a lot of younger African Americans don't like this subject either. When the subject of slavery would come up in history class or something like that, a lot of them would just sort of were I don't know if the right word is embarrassed. I don't know what the right word is, but they didn't want to engage in the conversation and they didn't really want to talk about it. They sort of shied away from it. But the other point I wanted to make is that I think as long as we continue to focus on race, we'll never get anywhere. And I'm sorry that, and I don't mean to, please don't take us the wrong way. I'm not disparaging this 90 Forward or what you're doing. It's important work, what you're doing. And I hope, wish the best. But I think what we need to focus on is economics. And the reason I say that is because as a person who's in a lower economic strata myself, I have a lot in common with a lot of other African Americans who maybe live on the north side or so on. And I would like to join with them politically. And I have. I mean, I vote Democrat. We, you know, with Joe Biden, and you saw this with Hillary Clinton and, of course, Barack Obama. But I think that we need to focus on economics and the fact that there are a lot of white people that are in the same sort of situation that African Americans are in. And if all those people that were in that same strata got together, we would make a formidable political bloc. But instead, here we are, Antifa, Black Lives Matter. I know that's important, and I'm not saying it's not important, but I think we're sort of, we seem like we're spinning our wheels. I mean, how long have we been doing this, that we're with the same approach to black and white? What about just economics? I mean, Martin Luther King, at the end of his career, when he was shot, he was given a speech in Memphis about the garbage union, the garbage collectors union. It was so he was starting to focus on economics. He had moved away from race and was moving toward economics. It's one thing to be free and have all the rights that you're entitled to, but if you don't have economic freedom, which can only be guaranteed politically by a coalition of poor people who get together and say, we're all together, regardless of race, and we're going to vote as a block. We could get the whole system cleaned up pretty quick if we did that. Anyway, thanks for taking my
time. All right, Mark. Thanks, Mark. Dr. Allen.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is along this journey of getting people to have dialogues about race, the one thing that I have personally been trying to do, and we as an organization have been I'm encouraging people to do, black people in particular, is to share their stories. because I don't think that the young African-Americans that you referred to, I don't think that they were embarrassed because I think they know their history pretty well. I think what typically happens in those spaces is that they become under a microscope and everybody looks at them. And they are having to compose themselves and wear the mask that Black people often wear in public settings when these topics come up. But one of the things that I'm encouraged by is that because of the race cards and because of the work that we're doing with the Jacksonville Community Remembrance Project, we are allowing Black people to tell their stories from their perspective. So that's part one. And part two, to answer your question, I think, or your statement, is I think we really have to be careful because a lot of times economic situations in poor, low socioeconomic status have become synonymous with being Black. And I think that that is an unfortunate comparison or connection that is automatically linked in the minds of America. There are Black people who are doing all sorts of things. There are Black leaders in the city who are, you know, leading by the growth in, you know, higher economic tax brackets, who are working to improve conditions for people in our city in general. And then I think when we talk about improving the lives of people in lower socioeconomic statuses, we're not just that's not just for Black people, that's for anybody. And I think one of the things, again, I want us to come out of the deficit mindset in thinking that because a person is poor or because a person lives in a certain area that they are, they don't feel that they have power. They have power, and a lot of times they know that they have the power, and that needle is going to move for all of the people who sit in that area. There's a misconception, though, that by helping Black people, everybody else is left out. And I think that that is, again, one of the narratives that has been spun about what, you know, Black Lives Matter movement means, et cetera. But really, it is helping everybody who is in that area. But we cannot have that conversation, quite honestly, until we are ready to acknowledge what has happened historically to purposely disenfranchise Black and African American people in the country. And so until we are willing to have that conversation on a larger scale, point directly to those policies that have left communities disenfranchised, antiquated things that are written in our legislation, we're going to have to continue to talk about race.
All right. Well, let me get in a few more calls. Keith in Riverside. Go ahead, Keith.
Good morning, Melissa. The doctor, the lady just pretty much summed up everything I was going to say. Black students aren't embarrassed about slavery. They're disheartened because of the way it's presented and the fact that most white people don't really seem to make the connection between what happened to the enslaved people and what is happening now, where it's a straight line of economic oppression and denial of resources and opportunity, which is leading to the perception that poor equals Black. There are more poor white people in America than there are Black, but the face of poverty in America is Black, and that is intentional. So you cannot separate race from economics, because it is the economic programs and decisions that have consistently kept Black people at the bottom.
Thanks, Keith. Belinda in Jax. Go ahead, Belinda.
Hi. Yeah, I was just kind of to tail on what he was saying and what the doctor was saying. I have this conversation all the time with people who say that, you know, we all have the same opportunity now. What's the problem? Why is this still an issue? And I really don't have a rebuttal, but the doctor kind of opened my eyes to something, and it really hit home with me. Now, I'm not one of those people who say that. I get it. But I now understand that not everybody grew up privileged. And I think that's the problem, is there's a lot of white people that grew up poor, that grew up abused, that grew up without two parents, that grew up in rough neighborhoods and had to dig themselves out were not given anything in their life and worked hard for where they are now. So when people call them privileged, they get upset.
Yeah.
So I get that now. I get that everybody's privileged in a certain way, in what, like the doctor said, gender, race. We're all privileged in a certain way. And I think we need to make that more of a conversation so that people don't feel like they're being left out of that conversation.
That, yeah, Belinda, feel defensive. Thank you for that. Jim tweets the show, economics alone is not the issue. LeBron James is rich, but he still experiences racism. Dave tweets, privilege is defined by the things you don't have to worry about. I never worry about encounters with police, my next paycheck, where I'll sleep tonight, how I'll put gas in my car. It leads to a lack of awareness of the struggles of others. Here's a tweet from Tony. A good start would be for any organization that receives city funding, their board and staff should reflect the city as a whole, considering they get taxpayer money. You can mandate this by ordinance. That has been done with arts and culture. That's a good point, Tony. Here's an email from Ed. Racism in any form is bad, but how many African Americans in this city were killed by racist-related violence versus black-on-black killings, he says. Dr. Allen, what about that question?
That is something that I see quite a bit. And the stats that I have seen, just as much as black-on-black crime happens, white-on-white crime also happens. Or Hispanic on Hispanic crimes, because crime in general tends to be violent crime. We're talking about, because I'm assuming he's talking about, you know, gun related violence, or tends to be between people who know each other.
Right.
But what the focus is, that the lens shifts when we are talking about encounters with the police. And that is where there is a critical difference that needs to be drawn in between those statistics. That is missing again from the narrative. When black people encounter the police, the chances of it's a higher likelihood that they end up, you know, arrested in jail, unfortunately dead in some cases, than when it is a white person who encounters the police.
So with all of that said, everyone's going to take a break for the holiday. You'll get to work in January. How can people join your efforts?
Absolutely. Please visit 90forward.org to our resources page for things to view, to watch, to view, to listen, and to read. We also have our event coming up with the Jacksonville Community Remembrance Project, where we will be honoring Eugene Barnum, who was unfortunately killed in the Dinsmore area. Through some historical work that we've done. So visit 904.org/activities to register for that virtual event. It's January the 3rd at 3 o'clock p.m. Engage with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at 90forward. And feel free to donate to our organization as well. As we continue to do this work, your support is necessary.
Dr. Kimberly Allen, new CEO of 90forward. Have a great holiday.
Thanks to you, Melissa. Thank you.
Much more still ahead later on. Some positive news and notes for your midweek in our What's Good Wednesday. That's later, but up next.
What are we going to do now that we're shut down? We have all of these actors who want to act. How do we make this thing happen?
Live performers. They've been sitting on the sidelines throughout the pandemic, but they're back in the game virtually. And it's a game you can play. We'll speak with the creator of The Secret Library. That's next.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. Well, this year's pandemic has impacted every industry, but perhaps none so much as live entertainment. Nationwide, the shutdown of the theme parks in Central Florida, plus Broadway and other live venues has left thousands of actors, musicians, and performers out of work. Otto Tees Entertainment, a leading expert in atmospheric entertainment, was also a company hard hit. But they tapped into their creative community to launch a new immersive theatrical experience online called The Secret Library. Now, anyone from around the world can enjoy a fully interactive live performance right from their couch.
Todd, thanks so much
for
being with us.
For the first time ever, live performers are engaging in a 100% live digital entertainment experience. It connects performers who interact with you, the audience, in real time. This is really cool. Participants work together to solve escape room style puzzles in these shows, and they actually affect the characters of the show and create a new and different experience every night. Audience members worldwide are playing virtually based on their time zone, so different shows are available at different times throughout the day. I spoke about this new form of entertainment with Todd Zimmerman. He is the Orlando-based creator of The Secret Library, and he told me how you can play, too. Take a listen. Hey, Todd. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This sounds like a genius idea that you've come up with, The Secret Library. We can immerse ourselves in a theatrical experience right from home, perfect for these times. So how'd you come up with this concept?
Well, you know, when you say genius idea, I need to give credit where credit is due, and that is to my lovely wife, who has been working with me as long as we've been married and somehow still loves me. But beyond that, we've wanted to create an immersive experience for a number of years, and it becomes a little bit cost prohibitive when you're looking for an actual physical space. So for us to be able to do this virtually and online has become something that we're very, very proud of, and it all stems from a conversation that she had with me one night.
Oh, and what was that conversation?
That conversation is, what are we going to do now that we're shut down? We have all of these actors who want to act. How do we make this thing happen? And I said, you are brilliant. Let's talk to all of our employees, all of our actors, and see what their creative brains can come up with, and The Secret Library is born out of that.
So the way this works is there are live performances, and we are watching them through our virtual devices. But what's cool is that the audience is connected to the performance. You have interactivity with the audience in real time, and you're trying to solve, the audience is trying to solve puzzles. So how does this work?
One of the things that we're very proud of is the fact that we wanted to create, like I said, an immersive experience, and that's hard to do when you're staring at your computer screen. So the storyline takes place actually in modern times and gives you the opportunity, as you said, to be very interactive in solving the mystery of the secret library. And we do that through different puzzles that our audience has to be actively involved in. We do that through clues that are provided by our characters, and they have an opportunity to interact one-on-one with the actors. So there's never a moment that you feel like you're sitting there just watching something. Netflix does a really good job of that. We're not trying to corner that market. What we are trying to do is to keep live entertainment alive by having people being able to interact with our performers throughout the experience.
So this is like playing a board game with all of your friends, like Clue or something, but you're playing it with some amazing performers and maybe with people from all over the world. What has the response been to The Secret Library since you started this thing?
We have had people, we've had people visit us from, like you said, all over the world, from Europe, from Australia, from Canada and Mexico, and then right here in the United States, because right now the pandemic is a worldwide problem. And The Secret Library is kind of an answer to that. And it is an opportunity to play a game like Clue. It is an opportunity to play with puzzles like an escape room. It's an opportunity to interact with performers like a murder mystery. And all at the same time, you can do that with your friends from all over the planet or right next door, but within the safety of your own home.
Now, you've got a couple of options right now. There's The Secret Library Origins and then a holiday-themed The Secret Library Krampus. So tell us about these.
Sure. So The Secret Library, the crux of it is being able to open a mystical library that is going to help solve all the world's problems because it contains all of the knowledge humanity has ever created, has ever had. So the idea is that we want to open the secret library to help us solve the problems of the world. And that leads us to our next story, which is in doing so, we also now have access to some amazing literary figures, one of those being Krampus, who is the Germanic demon that is out to ruin Christmas. So it's an opportunity for us to play a little bit in that mystical side of things with Krampus trying to, well, I'll say it, he's kidnapped Santa Claus.
Oh, no.
And, we have to get him back to save the holidays.
So this sounds like something you could play with your kids then, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have been in the family entertainment business for almost 20 years, and so we're real excited to be able to bring an offering to families that they can play, again, wherever they are. And now that we can't travel to get together with our families at the holidays as much, Krampus was a perfect opportunity for that, and it's something for everyone.
It's secretlibrary.io to play, and I'll say that URL again in a minute. But Todd, you know, you're based in Orlando, center of live performance and entertainment. You're very much locked into that whole world. Once this pandemic is over and all of the performers that you're involved with go back to live performing, will you keep up the Secret Library? Do you think it has a life beyond the pandemic?
Absolutely. What we're finding is that people that are coming and experiencing it are enjoying it enough that it does provide that outlet for friends to get together on a regular basis that may not always see each other. And people to experience live theater, we know that it's going to take a while for that to get back up to speed to where it was. Some people may not be comfortable going out in groups for some time. So we do feel that even after the world reopens, as it were, we have an opportunity for friends from around the world to get together and for people to still feel safe and do something that they really enjoy doing.
Okay, so with all of that said, you can join the Secret Library at secretlibrary.io, secretlibrary.io. Use the code HOME for a 10% discount for a limited time. Get on and play and interact with some amazing cast members, performers that are putting their talents to use in this crazy time that we are living through. What a genius idea. And kudos, Todd, for coming up with it and being so resilient in this pandemic, which we're all having to do.
Thank you very much. We do look for ways to pivot, and we think we've done it well. So thank you for having us on.
In November, the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine is being distributed across Florida this week, and other vaccines are being tested now, including one from Johnson & Johnson subsidiary Janssen Pharmaceutical. In November, our sister station WLRN in Miami spoke with the head researcher at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine about the trials for this vaccine. Greg Cooper is one of the volunteers. He's a government teacher at Ransom Everglades School in Miami. And he spoke with reporter Veronica Zaragovia. Take a listen.
Why did you decide to sign up for this vaccine trial?
About 10 years ago, I had lymphoma, and I had great care at UM, at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And as COVID was unfolding, I heard about all the research that was going into vaccines, going into drug development. And, I thought about sort of my own experience and how I certainly benefited from research that was done on drugs for chemotherapy, for example, in the past. And it struck me that there weren't a lot of things I could do, right? I'm a high school teacher. I'm not involved in the medical field at all. But it seemed that as these sorts of efforts were unfolding, they were only going to unfold at the speed that we needed them to unfold, right, as a society, if people volunteered. And the vaccine studies, and I had looked into a lot of the technology behind the vaccines. The Janssen trial, for example, is using essentially a cold virus vector for the coronavirus protein. And that's a technology that's been used in other vaccines. So I felt like it had been tried before. It was safe in other contexts. I honestly felt like the risk was pretty low and the benefit was high. And as the doctor who's running the study at UM said in your interview with him, this only works if people volunteer.
In the study, you don't know if you're receiving the placebo or the actual vaccine, but how are you feeling so far?
It's only one shot, which is nice. So I feel fine. I did have a reaction to the vaccine. My arm was a little sore. The next day, I had just kind of a slight little bit of muscle aches, a little bit of kind of chills, and for me, a low-grade fever, but that's like 99, right? And it lasted all of 4 or 5 hours. So sort of I got the shot on a Wednesday, and then the next morning I was perfectly fine. And ever since then, I've been fine.
Volunteers in this Janssen study get compensated somewhere around the $1,000 mark. Do you think compensation matters?
You know, I hadn't given it much thought when I went. I guess it was in the back of my mind that they did compensate people for these. I think I was assuming they might compensate me for, like, parking, you know, I'm not upset that I'm getting a little bit of compensation for it. Certainly, not only travel expenses, right, but there is a risk involved. It's helpful, right? Especially if you're trying to get a cross-section of people, if you're trying to get a diverse group of people, and you're trying to, I mean, honestly, show people that you value the time and the risk that they're taking. It is true that it's a bit of an unknown. And for a lot of people, that might be tough to get over. And I also think for a lot of people, it's tough to spend the time going to the visits. And I think it probably helps get a more diverse group of recipients than simply, a subset of people who can already afford the time and have the flexibility with their work and have the ability to do these things.
What kind of reactions have you been getting from people about your decision to volunteer?
Mostly positive. One or two are a little bit more skeptical. Really? Okay, good. Have you inquired how safe that? Those sorts of responses. But honestly, the response has been very positive. Most people have just been sort of intrigued at the process, just trying to better understand what it entails. A few have expressed concern about, okay, so what happens when a vaccine actually does come out, right? You'll be in the middle of this trial and you might not necessarily be able to go out and benefit from that right away. I've actually discussed it a little bit with my students because we've been talking about drug development. We've been talking about the role of the FDA and how government has been involved in funding some of these efforts. And what does it mean for something even to go through the FDA approval process? Why do we have the FDA to begin with? Which has been good. I mean, I think it's good for the students to see that all this stuff is not theoretical. And they seemed interested also. I mean, there seems to be a real sense of community spirit. We're all in this. When I've told people what I've been doing, the response has been very much, oh, that's great. Not everybody's necessarily willing to do it themselves, but the response has been very positive, which has been nice.
That was Greg Cooper speaking with WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia. Cooper is a volunteer in the trials testing Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. And when we come back, we are dashing through December with some positive news and notes for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays up next.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and services tailored for active retirees. Information at vickerslanding.com.
The Harry Smith Anthology, which collects blues and folk recordings of the 20s and 30s, has been called the founding document of the American folk revival. On the next Fresh Air, the curators of a collection of the flip sides of those 78s. And we hear from comic Amber Ruffin, a writer and performer on Late Night with Seth Meyers and the host of her own comedy show. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Where you been so long? I'm Lisa Mullins. After 17 years without a federal execution, the Trump administration resumed them in July. Since then, 10 federal inmates have been executed. Three more are scheduled for January. With President-elect Joe Biden saying he'll put a moratorium on capital punishment, we'll look at how the death penalty was used in 2020. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
As the Trump presidency winds down, his administration is picking up the pace of federal executions. Not since Grover Cleveland's presidency in the late 1800s has the government executed federal inmates during a presidential transition. Why now? We'll look at the present and future fight over the federal death penalty. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, does it feel like a race to make it to the end of the year? It sure does here in our little corner of the world at WJCT. Wrapping all the loose ends this week, buying those few final gifts, and planning for time with family as we all seek to wind down this crazy year of 2020 is our focus this week. And this is our final What's Good Wednesday of the year, so we've rounded up some holiday goodies just for you to enjoy, beginning with the beloved holiday tradition that continues this year in the nation's oldest city, pandemic or not. Yes, the St. Augustine Ballet is staging the Nutcracker again this season with some precautions. If you want to take in the magic of the Sugar Plum Fairy and all of the show's delights, be advised, CDC guidelines will be followed to ensure a safe experience for all. You'll see some limited seating and other modifications as the Nutcracker takes the stage at the Lewis Auditorium the week before Christmas. Check their website for show times and enjoy some Tchaikovsky, people. A few shout-outs now. Panavedra's Save a Leg, Save a Life Foundation has received $300,000 worth of breakthrough wound care treatment from Jacksonville's Next Science. That's a med tech company. Chronic wounds affect millions of people, and they represent heightened health risks, particularly in this pandemic. Now, this local gift is part of Next Science's $600K donation program with 3M Company for organizations treating patients who suffer from chronic wounds. She's a junior at the Episcopal School of Jacksonville and active in the local theater scene. Jacksonville teen Gabby Parker is also organizing a virtual walk this month for Sjögren's syndrome to raise awareness about this little-known autoimmune disease. Gabby has dealt with this for several years, and she is successfully managing it. You can search online for her sign-up page and take part. And you won't be able to dash through the snow, but you can still make like Rudolph this week at Dashing Through Downtown. It's a five-day celebration of the holidays, encouraging the support of locally owned businesses in the city's urban core. And it's your chance to just enjoy the holiday vibe downtown. Now, all this week, players have been entering a join code in the Event Z app to participate in this QR code scavenger hunt. It's going on at local businesses. And the way it works is you all compete to win prizes while you also shop and support local vendors. The first 200 players who seek out and scan at least 10 QR codes at participating businesses will receive a $20 Downtown Jack's e-gift card from Downtown Vision. And you'll also be entered into a drawing to receive some cool prizes, stuff like a Wolf and Cub gift basket, two Jacksonville Symphony tickets, and two Gotuckin tour passes, not too shabby. So check that out. It's Dashing Through Downtown all this week. That's a little taste of our What's Good Wednesday that we do every week. We will send out an e-newsletter today, too, our final one of 2020. You can subscribe to our newsletter on our website at WJCT.org. If you have some positive notes you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, just email them to us, too, at FirstCoastConnect@WJCT.org, so we can hopefully get them into What's Good Wednesdays. Now, to keep the positive vibes going, we're going to close the show with one of my favorite people. He's local musician Goliath Flores. He's such a talent. And recently he posted his very cool take on a Christmas classic, Carol of the Bells. It's a bossa nova Christmas, so enjoy the music, everyone. We'll be back tomorrow.
songs of the cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, 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 merry Christmas. Merry, 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 merry Christmas.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.